In this session, we're going to again start with a meditation, a Vipassana practice. So based on what we did in the last session where we were observing the mind as the basis for the shamatha practice, now we're going to do the same again. We're going to observe the mind as the object and whatever is arising in the mind. But now we're going to investigate these appearances, going into Vipassana mode. And as we did yesterday, we'll begin by emphasizing the first of the three marks of existence, impermanence. So we're going to be looking at the mind and then looking at what's appearing in the mind and having a look at the nature of that in terms of whether it's something stable and unchanging or whether it's actually changing moment by moment. So we'll bring that into the meditation. Okay, so let's start with that practice now. So we begin by preparing the body. The two most important aspects with the posture is to keep the back nice and straight and allow the entire body to become completely relaxed. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And preparing the mind, allowing it to come to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Again, allowing the eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And bring your attention to your own mind, observing your own mind and whatever mental events arise in the mind. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness, observing mental events as they arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. If you find yourself getting caught up in agitation or distraction, use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax, to release grasping onto any thoughts, and very gently return to observing the mind. or if you find that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then you can use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus on the mind. Let's now move from shamatha to vipassana, moving from observing the mind to investigating the mind. So now for everything that appears in the mind, is there anything, any appearance that is stable and unchanging? Or is everything constantly changing from moment to moment? Investigate. Currently, we're looking in the fifth outline of the Vaibhashika philosophical system, and we're looking at what is the illustration of the person. And here, of course, within Buddhism and a number of other traditions, we talk about a continuity, not just within this life, but from life to life. And we talk about the continuity of doing actions and then experiencing the result, the principle of cause and effect in terms of karma. So, therefore, who is this agent or person that has this continuity? And so all the Buddhist philosophical systems need to posit something that explains this continuity, this what is this really the person. And as we saw earlier, a number of other traditions at the time of the Buddha were also talking about life after life and something attaining liberation and so forth. And a number of these traditions were positing the person as being this self or atma. And they were positing it as having three qualities. As being unchanging, unitary, meaning a single thing with no parts, and completely independent of body and mind. So this was said to be the real person, the one that sort of continues from life to life and achieves liberation. But this idea, of course, is an idea of person completely independent of body and mind. And all Buddhist philosophical systems would reject this. Because all Buddhist philosophical systems assert that the person is dependent on the body and the mind, not independent. And when we saw in the last session, when we talk about the basis of the person being the body and the mind, this is often presented using the presentation called the five aggregates. In Sanskrit, skanda literally means heap. So five aggregates are the five collections or five heaps that make up a person. So we can talk about the body and the mind. The body is the first of five aggregates called the form aggregate. So the form aggregate with respect to the person is the body. But these five aggregates can also be a presentation of all functional phenomena. So there, the form aggregate would include all the physical reality as well, all the physical world. But here we're using this as a presentation as the basis of a person, and so there the form aggregate is equivalent to the body. The other four aggregates together is the mind. And the mind we can divide up many ways. For here, the way it's divided up, the mind, is initially into two, what's called main mind and mental factors. So main mind is the aspect or part of the mind that, in terms of our experience, simply contacts the entity of the object. It's the raw experience of the object. Whereas the mental factors are all the various factors that contribute to determine what type of experience we have. And in the mental factors, generally we come up with a list of 51. And of course, I'm not going to go into this in detail at all, because this is a whole topic itself that I think some of you probably have studied, Loewig, minds and awarenesses. But in these mental factors, more than half are mental afflictions, so it seems like the way we experience things often is not so good. But in here, there are two mental factors that are very important that really get a lot of attention in Buddhist psychology. The first of those is feeling. And feeling is not as we normally understand the word feeling. Normally when we generally use the word feeling, we're talking about emotions. Here in Buddhist psychology, feeling doesn't mean emotion. It means simply experiencing things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it's on the basis of that, particularly our pleasant and unpleasant feelings or experiences, that we often generate attachment and aversion. So this can lead to a lot of problems in terms of mental afflictions and inappropriate behaviour. So therefore, this mental factor is taken out of the list and put separately. To highlight the importance of feeling, to understand that often it's our pleasant and unpleasant experiences that lead to mental afflictions and a lot of suffering. But there's another mental factor here that also is very important, called discrimination. Discrimination is our ability to distinguish things clearly, to distinguish one thing from another. So, of course, if we can't clearly distinguish things, then on that basis, if we wrongly distinguish things, often our behaviour is inappropriate because we can't clearly distinguish what actually it is. So therefore, this is brought out separately to highlight that fact. And then all the other mental factors are the fourth aggregate, often translated as something like compositional factors. And they're called compositional factors because these mental factors are literally composing what our future is going to look like. Because depending on which ones of those are present in our behaviour is going to largely determine our future experiences. So they're literally composing our future existence, what it's going to look like. In Sanskrit, of course, this word here is samskara. And in the Goenka Vipassana retreat, he talks quite a lot about this, and he calls this the reactive mind. Because a lot of these mental factors are our reactions, are our mental afflictions, anger, jealousy, craving, anxiety, and so forth. So we tend to react to situations, and that's composing not a very good future. So these three together is the mental factors. And so the fifth aggregate is what's left over, the main mind. So this is the five aggregates presentation. The first form aggregate is the body, and the other four together is the mind. Any questions about the five aggregates?
Just say what the Buddha nature is.
Buddha nature. well, of course, here within the Vaibhashika Satrantika, there's no such thing. So Buddha nature is something that we see in the Chittamatra Madhyamika philosophical system. So that's the first point. And then within those systems, it depends, the word Buddha nature can be used differently. So there are different assertions within Chittamatra and Majjhimika. And even in within Majjhimika, there are also different ideas about what Buddha nature is. So maybe it's best to leave that till next weekend. But if we want to keep very simple, of course, then in terms of, well, no, we have to bring in a lot of other things, but Buddha nature generally is either usually defined as either the potential for enlightenment or the fact that at deepest level we're already enlightened. So often then when we talk about potential for enlightenment, this is coming within the general Prasangika view, and there, of course, it ties in with the idea of emptiness, is that we can become enlightened because of emptiness, because emptiness enables us to eliminate all the mental afflictions. So, therefore, sometimes within the Prasangika, Buddha nature is the emptiness of the mind, which is, of course, none of those. In another system, particularly with what we have in the Tibetan system in the Nyingma and Kagyu school, where they talk about Mahamudra Dzogchen, at that level they're talking also what's called Vajrayana or Tantra. So there they talk about very subtle mind of clear light, given many names. Often they point to that as Buddha nature, which of course is not in this list, because that's what's talking about very subtle mind. And at this level, these philosophical systems don't accept that exists even. So the brief answer is that Buddha nature only comes in the Chittamatra and Majjhimika system, and how it's defined there doesn't come in any of these five aggregates.
You said this is a list of the unenlightened mind. Consciousness is consciousness split into either sensory perception or mind.
Yeah, the idea of levels of mind, of course, even here we can talk about levels of mind, but they all come within what's called coarse mind. We only see presentations of this very subtle mind in the context of Tantra or Vajrayana. And so that only comes in the Chittamatra or Majjhimika philosophical system. So there's no reference here at all to very subtle mind at all. But that's going to come next weekend. Any other questions on the five aggregates? Okay. So on that basis, let's have a look now at the Vaibhashika assertions of what is the illustration of the person? And we saw there a couple of different assertions within the various sub-schools. And the first talks about most of them accept the mere collection of the five aggregates to be the person. And to comment on that, again, we can refer to the book here, because he goes through each of the various assertions and what their implications are. So he says the following, this is on page 38, talking about the mere collection of the five aggregates. There are many kinds of vaibhashikas, and this is one of the issues on which they disagree. However, most of them would say that the person is the mere collection of the five aggregates of body and mind, there being no substantially existent person. What they mean by mere is also what is meant by not substantially existent. A person is something that comes to mind only in dependence on perceiving something else first. For instance, I cannot say that I have perceived a person until I have at least seen a body, heard a voice, or seen writing. The person is whatever is used within the five aggregates as a basis for recognizing someone as a person. It is not an independent category, as some of the non-Buddhist schools accepted or asserted in terms of that unchanging, unitary, independent idea of a person. This understanding of person would seem to avoid the problems mentioned in relation to the non-Buddhist schools, the first idea up here. It is not some sort of permanent, unchanging entity apart from body and mind, nor is it some aspect of the aggregates that would not be continuously able to provide a place to point. But it is, to be sure, a slippery concept. It is supposedly not separate from the aggregates, yet it is not any one of them itself. So this is the first assertion most of the Vaibhashikas accept. Then we have the second one here, the Aparantikas, the Vaibhashikas from the Western region, accept the mental consciousness to be the illustration of a person. So here, when we talk about mental consciousness, as John briefly mentioned in his question, I think, is another way of dividing up mind is into what's called the six consciousnesses. So the five sense consciousnesses, of course, are the visual, auditory, olfactory, and so forth, and the tactile. So the five has the five sense objects as their objects. And the mental consciousness, of course, is the aspect of the mind that has mental objects as its object, thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images, and so forth. So many of the Buddhist schools, not just within Vaibhashika, as we see in that chart, many of the higher schools also posit this as the illustration of the person, because that's something that is a more continuous, stable entity than the sense consciousnesses. So to talk a little bit more about that, again, we can look at the book here on page 39, and here, when we talk about these six consciousnesses, a lot of this, and particularly when we look in Sautrantika later today, maybe, or tomorrow, we talk a lot about, of course, valid cognition and inference and so forth. And a lot of this, a lot of these theories within Sautrantika and also Chittamatra are coming really from Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti in the 7th century was very well known for this epistemology, for really explaining a lot about what is a valid mind and so forth. So a lot of this is coming from him. And it's saying here, in Dharmakirti's system and in Buddhism generally, there are six types of consciousness. In addition to the mental consciousness, which discriminates and cognizes and cogitates, there are five consciousnesses associated with the senses. So now we're talking about the mental consciousness being the illustration of the person. It says, this solution seems to suffer the objection that the mental consciousness does not operate continuously, at least at times of unconsciousness. Vasubandhu says in his 30 stanzas that there are five such cases, including deep sleep and fainting and so forth. So many of the schools posit the mental consciousness as the actual illustration of the person, the one that where karmic imprints are stored, and the one that continues from life to life. But as said here, and I think Svatantrika's, one of the higher Majjhimika systems, refines that a little bit and says actually it's a subtle level of mental consciousness, because mental consciousness itself, the one we have actual now, as mentioned here, in some cases is not really continuously there when we're in deep sleep or so forth. So therefore, sometimes they argue that this couldn't really be, and the Svatantrikas make this argument, that just the normal mental consciousness can't be the illustration person because sometimes it's not active. It's not, so it's not continuous. But a lot of the schools do posit this as the illustration of the person. And then we have one more assertion here from the Kashmiris that talk about the continuum of the aggregates as the person. So to comment on that, we have the following. He says, perhaps these schools realized that there were significant problems with the possibility of collection. In any case, they identified as the person the continuum or stream, the mere succession of moments of the body and mind. This too avoids problems of identifying entity that exists outside the aggregates or cannot always be present. Change is always occurring in our body and minds, and quite possibly there are times when there is no particular function in consciousness, but there is always something present such that we can say that a stream continues. During life, there is always a body, but even before and after life as well as during it, there is a stream of moments of consciousness. So therefore, here the Kashmiri Vaibhashikas and some other schools as well assert the continuum of the aggregates as the illustration of the person. So if we see in the Four Buddhist Tenet Systems chart, most of the other schools, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, Madhyamika, also posit one of those that we have just discussed. In the Sautrantika, we see the continuum of aggregates and the mental consciousness. Also, one of the sub-schools in Chittamatra talk about mental consciousness. Also, the one branch of Sautrantika talk about mental consciousness. But then we have two other assertions, one called mind basis of all, and the Prasangika talk about mere I. So even though we're not covering those systems this weekend, I thought since we're on this topic now, let's bring them in and see how that compares with these assertions that we've just covered. So what is this mind basis of all that the Chittamatrans and one of the Svatantrika schools assert as the illustration of the person? So here again, we have a discussion about this in this book here. And this mind basis of all is really coming down to also this assertion that because the mental consciousness is not always active or present, that can't really be the thing that is the continuity. So actually, in the Chittamatra system, they, instead of having the six consciousnesses presentation, they end up with eight consciousnesses. They have a presentation of eight. So they have these six, and then they have what's called afflicted mentality. And mind basis of all as the eighth consciousness. And they introduce these ideas to overcome these difficulties with regard to the mental consciousness being the illustration of the person. And so mind basis of all is what they assert as the illustration of the person. And the mind basis of all in Sanskrit is alaya vijnana. Sometimes it's translated into English as like storehouse consciousness, foundational consciousness, substrate consciousness, given a number of different names. And they introduce this as a very neutral type of consciousness that is always present and the place where karmic imprints are stored to overcome this sort of difficulty in asserting the mental consciousness being the person. And then the afflicted mentality is then an aspect of consciousness which apprehends the person, mind basis of all, and grasps onto that being a self. So that's something we need to eliminate. So to talk a little bit more about mind basis of all, we'll read from the book again here. He says the following. And remember, the Chittamatra system was really started to being developed by Asanga in the 4th century. And it says the following. These followers of Asanga introduce a new concept, that of the mind basis of all, a neutral, continuously operating consciousness with no other function than to hold the seeds of actions, karmic imprints. Indeed, the karmic latencies and the mind basis of all are a single substantial entity. They are never found apart from one another and are different only conceptually. Chittamatrans reject the other possibilities because they contend that all other consciousnesses are absent at some time or another. Therefore, it would be unsuitable for them to be the illustration of person, the person that is continuously present. Sense consciousnesses do not operate continuously, and some cannot operate at all if their physical basis is gone, such as in the case of blindness. Even if that were not the case, they see a problem in designating the mental consciousness, even a subtle level of it, as the person, because the mental consciousness can be virtuous or non-virtuous. They felt that whatever is the basis of seeds established by virtue or non-virtue should itself be neutral. Also, they asked, if the seed bearer were the mental consciousness, would that not mean that whenever we have a thought, there would be two simultaneous mental consciousnesses? So therefore, the Chittamatrans posit this mind basis of all as the illustration of the person. So what we see then is every philosophical system, except the Prasangika, point to something as the illustration of the person. Either the mental consciousness, the mind basis of all, the continuum of the aggregates, or the collection of the aggregates. They all point to something as the person. Whereas when we look at Prasangika, they're not pointing to anything. What's the person? The mere I. Because remember, Prasangika is asserting nothing exists from its own side. So actually, for things are not findable, so you can't point to anything as being that, that things are merely labelled. So the mere I here is simply person that is merely labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. So that's the illustration of person in Prasangika. But to really appreciate what that means, of course, we have to go into some more detail, which we're going to do next weekend. So I just wanted to briefly mention that here, that they stand apart from all the other schools in saying that there is nothing findable as the person. The person is the person that is merely labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. So any questions about any of these illustration of person before we move on in the text? Everyone's totally confused. Prasangika don't talk about karmic imprints. There is karma, but they don't use imprints as the as the concept to describe karma. So most of the lower schools would use the idea of imprints, you know, that there's an action, there's an imprint, and then that ripens, to describe the process of cause and effect. In Prasangika, they don't use that idea. So in Prasangika, there's no such thing as karmic imprints. So they use a different idea or presentation to describe the process of action and result. And they talk about what's called disintegratedness, which is quite something. It's not as, I think the idea of imprints is very simple to understand, you know, that there's just like an imprint and that imprint. So it's a very easy concept, whereas disintegratedness is a little bit different, but we don't have the time to go into that presentation here, just to be aware that in Prasangika they have a different way of describing. Of course, they accept karma and cause and effect, but they use a different concept to describe that process. So that's it. And then, of course, as with everything in Prasangika, that is associated with the person, of course. But in Prasangika, whether it's karma, the person, body, mind, it's not findable. You can't point to something and say, that's it. Because that would imply that it exists from its own side, that it's inherently existent. But yes, the actions are associated with the person, and the person being the mere eye in Prasangika. Yes.
Four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, some of them do talk about the mindfulness. So is there a missing subsection in here?
No. No. So remember again, whether we talk about six consciousnesses or eight, these are not separate, discrete things. You can't have a sense consciousness here and a mental consciousness here. These are aspects of the one mind. So there's not six separate consciousnesses. The visual consciousness is the aspect of the mind that engages in visual objects. So these are aspects. So it's useful to divide the mind up in this way in terms of the different objects we experience to understand how the mind operates. And so then the Chittamatrans find it useful to talk about this as an aspect of mind to understand the principle of karma and illustration of person. And so what you find is that also in some of the Tibetan systems, particularly the Mahamudra and Dzogchen, where they really emphasize the nature of the mind practice, it's also useful there to talk about something like this. It's very useful because of the perspective they have on practice. But the way in which they use this concept there is not the same as the Chittamatra. They use the same word, and there are some similarities, but that's where it ends. So it's not when we see this word used in and we often see that in the Mahamudra Dzogchen traditions, this way of describing consciousness, but when we look at it in detail, the way in which they use this word is not the same as the Chittamatra assertion. So we have to be a little bit careful with that. Yeah. Exactly. So the Prasangika idea is that, as with all the physical phenomena, mental phenomena, when we do an action and that action ceases, there is a, like, what's called disintegratedness. So that provides the continuum, to keep it very simple. But let's not go there now because it's a really a big topic. Yeah. Sure. So that's the Prasangika. Prasangika is saying that, like all functional phenomena, cause and effect, there's a continuum. So we don't need to introduce an extra concept of karmic imprints to describe the process. That's what their assertion is. Why introduce something extra to describe something when what you've already got in terms of cause and effect and impermanence is sufficient to describe the process? That would be what they would say. So disintegratedness is just saying that there's cause and effect operating also in terms of our actions. We don't need to introduce another concept and introduce another idea of imprints to describe that process. So as I was actually in the break mentioning with John Occam's razor, I think that applies here, doesn't it? Occam's razor, what was it again?
if you have two explanations, which both could possibly be true, choose the simpler one.
So that's what Prasangika would say. The simpler one is what we've already got. We don't have to add more by coming up with a new idea of imprints and so forth. So maybe it doesn't apply, but okay. Sure. Yeah, we have to be very careful here, and we're going to come into those five paths this afternoon and again tomorrow, is that also there, in terms of our mental afflictions and what they produce and so forth, there are also concepts there, seeds and latencies. That's not the same as karmic imprints. Because seeds and imprints are of mental afflictions. We're talking about mental afflictions, we're not talking about actions. Yeah. It's not identical. I mean, there's similar ideas, but we have to be very careful when we see this word latency or seed or something, what it's referring to, what's the context. Yeah. I'm not saying they're not totally unrelated, because as we eliminate mental afflictions and the seeds and latencies of that, we are also beginning to eliminate karmic imprints, according to these schools. Sure. Yeah, so there is a correlation there in that sense, but we're not talking about identical things. And even within the philosophical schools, when we talk about, as we're going to see starting this afternoon, when we talk about these latencies and so forth, what that means is not the same between the philosophical schools. So it's just a word, you know. Okay, any last question? Otherwise, it's time for lunch break. I think John likes to ask questions just before lunch so that, to annoy people so that they can't go for lunch break. So, you've done that. Any last question? Because after lunch we'll move on to the next part of the text. So if you have any questions about the person, now's the time to ask. Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's from a Buddhist perspective, when we're really talking about illustration of person, it's on the basis of the idea of there being a continuity in this life and in other lives, and a continuity in terms of our actions and results, you know. So any tradition that talks about something after this life and talks about the idea of liberation has to posit, what is that continuity? What is that person that moves from life to life and achieves liberation? And so what we saw was that at the time of the Buddha, a lot of the non-Buddhist traditions were positing this as that continuity, that the real essence of the person, whereas all Buddhist traditions would refute that idea. And as we've seen here, within the Buddhist traditions, the Buddhist philosophical systems, when they talk about that person, there's varying assertions, whether it's the mental consciousness, the continuum, so forth. And it's only the Prasangika that says, well, actually, you can't point to anything, because if you point to something, you're asserting that it exists from its own side, which they would refute. So their answer is the mere I, and what that really means, we're going to, of course, talk about next weekend. So actually, you know, on that very point, and then we'll finish for lunch, is the question is, and that's a question that all Buddhist systems and non-Buddhist systems who assert life after life or liberation have to answer, what goes from life to life? And so that's what this illustration of person is sort of trying to answer. But actually, the question itself is loaded. Because when we say what goes from life to life, it sort of implies there's findable. So technically, if you asked a prasangika what goes from life to life, the answer would be nothing. Because the question is loaded. The word goes implies there's a thing which is moving. But actually, if we, at a physical world level, if we don't investigate the physical world, it seems like there are things, like this pen, moving through time, yeah? It's the same pen that was here yesterday, same pen tomorrow. Is there any physical thing that moves through time? Is there? No. Because every physical thing, even according to Vaibhashika, is impermanent, changing moment by moment. So actually there's no thing that moves through time, even at the physical world level, because there's just a flow of change, isn't there? But we superficially say, this pen, same pen that was here yesterday and tomorrow. But if we really look closely, nothing, even at the physical world, is going through time. And at the mental level, nothing is going through time. There's just a flow of experience. And this is the basis on which Pasangika say mere I. There's a flow, and within that flow of body and mind, at each point you can give the name me or person. But there's nothing you can point to there as the person.
They just are looking for like a footprint of this person.
Like, so
consequence of the past.
Yeah. So all the lower schools, and this is something we're going to see more this afternoon and tomorrow, is for them, for something to exist, it must be findable. For Prasangika, for something to exist, it can't be findable. That's the big difference. To really appreciate what that means for Prasangika, we'll look at next week. Okay, let's break for lunch.